Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop. By Polar, chase your destiny. By Premium Plus Sports, official travel partner of the Tough Man Triathlon Series. By Swim Run USA. You can reach them at usa-swimrun.com. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we just sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 billion to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews at babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, a true legend of the sport of triathlon. He's not only a professor and the creator of TriHistory.com, but he is a two-time Ironman world champion and simply one of the members of the Big Four. Mr. Scott Tinley joins us. ST, how you doing?
That's an amazing intro, man. How many times have you done that? That is so good. You should go on the radio. You should be like a game show host, Bob. You're so good at this. Amazing.
Behind the curtain. What do we have behind the curtain?
How are things at Babbittville? I haven't been to Babbittville in several decades. Are
you know what?
Still as funky and hip and groovy as ever?
You know what? It's so much fun. It's the greatest thing in the world, getting to work with your lovely wife, Virginia, every day and change lives. And you've been involved with Challenge Athletes Foundation from the very beginning and brought Robin Williams on board. It's been a great journey. 25 years of CAF, 40 years of Ironman. We've both been connecting the dots with all that stuff. It's been great.
Wow. What a ride, eh?
Been great. So, speaking of the ride, when did you first find out about this crazy sport?
Well, the short of it is, I came down here from Orange County, where I grew up, to go to college in 1976. And wandered over to Fiesta Island on my bike one day and just happened to to see the 1976 Mission Bay Triathlon happening. And there was two of them that year. But this one was like, I'm going to say, early August. And I go, wow, this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, and I just pulled somebody aside and I go, hey, this is great. When's the next one? The guy goes, what do you mean next one? We barely had this one. This one's not even done yet. What are you talking about next one? There's no series. There's no sport. There's no, you know, organization or structure. It's just, if you're lucky, you know, you might see one maybe next month, maybe next year, maybe never. Get the San Diego Track Club news, and you'll be okay.
Yeah, so. And the San Diego Track Club basically was like, listen, we're getting bored running the boardwalk every day. Maybe we'll just toss in some swim run. It's not a sport. It's a workout.
Yeah.
That was sort of it.
I like to think of it as an excuse.
Exactly.
Henry, for a lot of people who are excusing themselves for either low performance in their running repertoire or you know, milking an injury, or that their car was broken down, they couldn't afford to fix it, so they're riding their bike to the workout, or they really sucked at swimming. I don't know. So generally, you know, the history of triathlon is about basically being lazy, which
exactly
sounds a little odd, but
no, it's true. And it's also for us sort of folks who have attention deficit. It's sort of like, okay, I'm swimming, this is fun, I'm getting bored, okay, I'm out of the water, okay, I'm riding, I'm getting bored, I'm done, my bike butt is hurting, I'm running for a little bit, oh, there's a beer. I mean, it's really for us guys and gals who just want to keep doing stuff all day long, right?
Right, right. So what else you got for me?
Yeah, exactly. So when did you, we had Ironman 78, 79, 80, Tom Warren, who you knew from his Tug Swim Run swim events, he's won in 79. Is that when you first heard about the Ironman thing, or was it after 80?
No, I had heard about it rumor-wise, you know, just living in Pacific Beach at the time and knowing some of those people, you know, because I was working at the Mission Bay Aquatic Center at the time teaching sailing. You know, and I'd done a little bit of lifeguarding, and my brother Jeff was down lifeguarding. You know, so we hear these things, oh, this thing in 78, you know, but back over in Hawaii, it's really hard. And we're just going like, we can barely afford the rent. Who's thinking about a vacation in Hawaii?
Yeah.
But what I do distinctly remember was when the May 4th Sports Illustrated article came out, Warren Tom Warren, who I knew fairly well at the time, he made a point because he was kind of living down the street from me. He rode his bike by, and he had the magazine in a rubber band with a note on it, and he left it on my front door. I was living at 1212 Missouri Street, yeah. Beach, and with this little note handwritten said, "You might like this."
That is,
and that was it, you know. And a little picture of a tugboat, because that was, you know, that was
his thing.
Sort of nom de plume, you know, that's how he signed himself. So
did he?
But I do remember reading that, and completely being bowled over by the whole concept, the ideology. This is the way it was written, and
yes.
You know, and then I knew Tom, and so that was a tipping point for me.
Yeah, and then of course the note was probably misspelled a couple different times.
I hope so.
Exactly. That's actually one of my prized possessions, having a tugboat from Tom Warren, personally carved tugboat with my name on it is like the high point of my life. So,
that's right, because you were inducted into the tugboat.
Exactly. Yeah, I never would have won one. There's no way I'd win a tugboat. It was like, oh my God, I'm going to get a tugboat without having to actually go fast, which I could never do.
Yeah, but think about that, Bob. All right, so how many people today in the world of modern sport, let alone triathlon, et cetera, during the induction ceremony for them, you know, being honored to go into some kind of hall, famous or not, would take that opportunity to induct two other people at that moment into a separate hall. And that's what Tom did, you know, at that awards at the SeaWorld. He's like, okay, you know, I'm going to put Bob Babbitt, and I forget who else was. I'm going to put these guys in my own hall of fame.
That was the coolest thing ever. That's just Tommy. That's Tommy. That's what made him so freaking special. And what I love another thing with that. I remember when wetsuits came about, and swim was basically you swam around Crystal Pier half mile, you ran 5 miles to the jetty and back in Mission Beach, and then you swam around the pier again. And if you were one of those runner guys, you better get a good lead, because the Jenny Lamotts and the real good swimmers would be swimming over your butt on the way around the pier again. So what was great is when wetsuits came about, everybody's like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? And Tommy, it is so simple, was like, listen, you can wear a wetsuit. You just can't start in it. So when the gun goes off, you want to go put a wetsuit on? Have fun with that. Yeah. Not a problem.
Exactly.
I love him.
I think he said the same thing about swim fins. You could use fins, but you had to run in them as well.
See, the whole world would be so much better if Tommy just made decisions on everything. Because everything would just work, right? Everything that he right? The Tom Warren solution would always be there.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, elaborate electronic timing that costs thousands of dollars, and there's all problems with him with the Bluetooth. And, you know, but if he's going to hand you a popsicle stick based upon how you came out of the water at the finish with your number on it. And there was no problem with a popsicle stick. Now, you either had number 6 or you had number 12, and there was no trading popsicle stick.
No. And then they immediately stapled those up on the wall, and you knew within 4 seconds where you placed. It was brilliant. The guy was brilliant, way ahead of his time. So you come over and do Ironman in 1981. And I remember Scott Molina saying, the guy had this bike, he had vice grips hanging on the back. And how prepared are you still? You had, the 81, your third place, so obviously you were up there. Did you feel like you were prepared for it after doing it? That was the first year over on the Big Island.
No, I was not prepared. I bought that bike at a place called Gemco. It's sort of a Costco predecessor. It was a membership only place. You know, cost like $6 a year to join Gemco. And my dad was a member, so he loaned me my after he passed away, I kept his card, and I was able to get into Gemco, and I bought this bike at Gemco for $189, which was like, you know, 6 months rent.
It's a lot of money.
I'll save for that. But yeah, it was, you know, it was my prized possession, and, you know, and I had been training, and but who knew? You know, if you weren't a cyclist, if you weren't into that subculture, and you didn't hang around with that particular group, which was very small at the time.
Yep.
There was very little information. And, you know, of course, magazines were from nondescript, and, you know, pre-internet, et cetera. You didn't know about drafting. You didn't know about aerodynamics. You didn't know about, you know, weight. We just thought comfort and reliability were the primary factors.
Right.
So, thus the vice grips and the baling wire and the chewing gum and duct tape in my toolkit.
Of course. Already, ready to go. And did you surprise yourself getting third place?
Yes. No, that was huge because that was, you know, going over there with no expectations and, you know, I was working full time. No idea. You know, Virginia and I were, let's see, recently married. So we went over there and it was like, wow, okay, so these people are pretty legit. I mean, they're kind of serious about this thing. Because our early connection to triathlon was what happened on Mission Bay on a Wednesday night.
Right.
You know, so, and it was like, wow, all these people, God, you know, they're all kind of nervous and, you know, they're just, they're not that friendly. And then, you know, I looked over at, I think it was Mark Montgomery's bike in the transition area, and he had this giant glass jar of peanut butter duct taped to his handlebars. And I go, like, God, that guy's so smart. Peanut butter duct taped to his handlebars. I need to go and find peanut butter. But, no, I you know, I looked, you know, my swim was horrible. It was like 112 or something. And then my bike was whatever it was, you know, with the vice grips and the tank top.
Yes.
And the the touring shoes. The touring shoes were the best. Because I'm not going to wear leather shoes.
No.
I think, you know, I think it was probably a skid lid helmet.
Yes.
Not because you had to have it, just because it was like, oh, well, like that fits in a cardboard box along with everything else. But getting off the bike, I don't know, 100 and something, and running into third, and it wasn't a very fast marathon. I, you know, it was probably 320 something.
Yeah.
But everybody else was running 420 something.
Right.
So just standing there going like, wow, this is interesting.
And then when you get home, then the thing airs on television. And you know, I don't know how much play you got in it, but you had to have some. All of a sudden, you're on national television. Nothing?
I don't think there was a note. It was Warren.
And John Howard.
And John Howard, yeah. But by anyways, I mean, there's some fantastical stories about, you know, John and that whole era of him being so far ahead of us, just understanding how bikes work and aerodynamics and drafting. And, you know, it's like, wow. I mean, to this day, I still don't remember him passing me on the bike. You know, and people say, well, that's because he was behind the van with the barn doors open.
Exactly. Remember, they used to say, hey, if the doors are open, you don't get a draft from the van. I used to
love that. The front windows are open and the air comes in the front window and goes back out the back. So there's no advantage of being behind the van with the doors open.
None whatsoever. So then you come back the following year and you win the thing. And that following February. Now, at this point, was there any sponsorship? There was no money in the race itself. Was there, you were still working a real job trying to become a paramedic at this point?
No, I was still at the Aquatic Center, you know, kind of a management position there, working full time. I had left the paramedic job just because, well, long story there. But so I just remember telling my boss, like, you know, I got to go over one more time and just get this whole thing out of my system. I need a week off. Please, please. You know, I mean, I promise. I'll just get rid of this whole triathlon thing and then I'll be done with it. He's like, okay, right.
Right.
But that was no sponsorship. I had a Bianchi bike.
Yes.
They gave me 25% off on it based upon my third place finish the year before.
Nice.
And I was getting free bags of Gookinade from Bill Gookin.
Yep.
And I think I got like two pair of free Adidas shoes and, check this out, a sweatsuit. One of those, like, you know, rap boy sweatsuits.
Yes, the Adidas rap boy sweatsuits. Yeah. Those were pretty sweet.
So that was the limit of my sponsorship.
And then when you win, so now you got to be on TV when you win.
Yeah, they tried to take me off because, you know, that was the Julie thing. And, of course, it was, you know, as it should have been. It was a tipping point for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But they couldn't ignore completely the male winner. So
right, and that was, you know, the battle with Dave Scott, right? As you guys were at one point riding together, and
yeah, but he sucked back then.
He was not that good. He was a little heavy. You know, he wasn't the cut machine that he became later.
Oh,
right?
God, did he ever pay me back though? I mean, God, just. I beat him once, and he had to go back and beat me six times just to make the point clear. Come on, Dave.
Come on. How about another?
Once or twice would have been good enough.
A little something for the effort. Come on now. Yeah, so the following year, I mean, that was you got second, you know, like 4 seconds. And then the one that always sticks out to me is 83, just because it was so close, 33 seconds. And you don't, you know, the hard part is getting any type of reliable splits out there, knowing where you are. You're sort of in no man's land.
Yeah.
When did you realize, well, I mean, did you have a, obviously on Elite Drive, you sort of see him coming across the line. You're like, oh my God, I'm not that far back.
There's a lot of backstory, but certainly Dave had his good buddy Pat Feeney out there. And Pat was a super smart guy. I think he was a grad student at the time. And he had figured out how to, you know, sort of keep track of all the competitors. You know, it's like a little running spreadsheet in his head. He had one of those early calculators the size of a, you know, like a coaster in his hand. I'd see Pat on the side and go, Pat, where's Dave? And he'd just look at me kind of stone-faced. And not
Dave who? That's great.
But I did, at one point, I did see Virginia maybe with 4 or 5 miles to go. She was out on the course.
Yeah.
She goes, you know, Dave doesn't look that bad. I mean, he doesn't look that good. He's only, you know, 3 minutes ahead. I'm thinking like, okay, I have to make up a minute, a mile. You know, come on. Seriously?
Yeah.
Can you just let me suffer and wallow in my own guilt here by myself? I'll see you at the finish line. She's like, all right. Anyways, and that was the absolute wrong move. You know, I should have just, like, turned it on right then. Because, you know, a mile later, I go, all right, you know what? I'm a jerk. I need to just finish this on my own accord, pick it up. And as soon as I picked it up, you know, I started running, like, 550s, 545.
Wow.
Damn.
I feel good.
This is good stuff. Yeah. But then, you know, seeing Dave at the finish line, 33 seconds ahead, he's on a stretcher. You know, he's got IVs coming out of him. I'm standing there going, like, dude, let's go again, man. Rematch.
Let's add a mile. Let's just add a half a mile. Maybe it'll add 50 feet and we'd be good. Wow. Well, but the nice thing is there wasn't a big difference between the prize money for first and second.
No, there wasn't. It was just the size of the trophy.
Zero.
The deal with carrying home a larger trophy than me. I just like, whatever.
Yeah, who cares?
I think I gave it to a kid on the side of the road.
But when you look at it, you go, you know, 81 third, 82nd, 82. There's two races, 82. You win, and you get second, then you get second, you get 83, and second again, 84, and then you win in 85 and get third in 86. I mean, that's a great stretch, right? And if you look at, you know, 2 wins, 4 seconds, 2/3, 1/4, and 3/6, you were so consistent over there. What was it about that course that was good for you?
Nothing really. I hated it.
Did you really?
I just didn't hate it as much as other people did. I think honestly, I seem to do reasonably well in the heat, and I had an ability to suffer a little bit.
Yes.
You know, where Mark and Dave and Scott Molina, you know, these guys are fantastic athletes, and Mike Pig, you know, just all those guys, you know, they're so talented, so smart, so, you know, so committed. The one thing that I had that enabled me was, like, I could hurt.
Right.
So yeah. when I was really hurting and everybody else was hurting, I'm going, okay, let's work. we've all been in lots of car crashes. Like, who wants one more right now? Next mile, car crash.
Yeah. Well, and that's what Todd Jacobs would say. He'd say, you know what, especially 1990 when you ran your way in the second, he goes, it was carnage out there. And Tinley can race in hell. That guy, it doesn't matter how hot it is, he's just going to run through the carnage and have great races. Well, you had that, there was a obviously with Team J David, it was you and Mark Allen and Scott Molina. And if we look at sort of the history of when athletes perform well, you look at Athletics West with Alberto Salazar and that whole group running together. And, you know, today the guys down in Tucson and Flagstaff and Mammoth Track Club, but athletes pushing each other. You guys were the epitome of that. How helpful was that to be able to get up each morning and train with Mark Allen and Scott Molina and push each other?
Well, that's, you know, you have to be a little careful with nostalgia there because, you know, if you only remember the good times, it can be a little deceiving.
Yeah.
And look, J. David didn't last that long. It was a nice little perk for us for a short period.
Yeah, but for all of us.
But it hurt a lot of people. And Jerry Dominelli and Nancy Hoover and you know, all those people that were associated, they were horribly wrong for what they did and, you know, sort of hurting many, many people in basically stealing their money. So
no question.
Let's be honest about that part.
Sure.
But certainly, you know, having an infrastructure of comrades and people who you could rely on and count on and push each other was a huge thing, because, you know, to be out alone and doing something, but, you know, like Dave up in Davis, you know, he's kind of this mythological figure.
Right.
We always thought, God, that's got to be tough.
Right.
You know, you're up there, you're riding up to Lake Berryessa by yourself every day, and then, you know, you're coaching swimming, and then you go for the run on these horribly flat parts of Davis. And we just think, you're like, wow, dude, no wonder you're so good. We're down here in La Jolla just hanging out and, you know, maybe going to get beer after our second workout.
Right, right.
So yeah, it was good. But I have to tell you, though, Bob, the real thing was having Molina move to Del Mar.
Yes.
And he lives 200 yards from where I'm still at. Now he's 2 days away by airplane. But, you know, he was in his first marriage, and he wasn't really happy. So he'd come by at 7 in the morning, and as he said, going to scoop you up. And we go do these five-hour donut rides at, you know, at 14 miles an hour. And then come back, and, you know, I'd say, I got to go to work, you know. And he goes, all right, well, I'm going to go run. And then he'd take a short nap, and then he'd go swim. And anyway, so, but just having, you know, that sustainability, that rock figure to admire, like, you know, this guy is freaking blue collar, you know, pull myself up by my bootstraps, you know, working class parents, I'm going to make it in this sport. And, I looked at that, and I go, like, you know, all right, that's admirable. So, you know, and that to me, that was a whole different kind of motivator than seeing Mark's talent, you know, or
sure.
Dave's solo efforts or Pig's, you know, kind of, you know, similar work ethic. But, you know, but Molina doing that during that year and a half to 2 years, I was like, shit. That's what I aspire to do.
Well, here he was, a guy flipping burgers up in Pittsburgh, California, and then he comes down here to Del Mar, and he had the background. I mean, it seemed like he understood the science, right? He had an idea of, I think you told me once that he said, listen, the top guys swim 30,000 yards a week, they ride 300 to 500, and they run 80 to 100, so I'll just take all three of those, put them together, train 40 hours a week, and kill everybody. And since you needed to compete with him, you sort of needed to do the same thing.
Which you know, is completely idiotic. You think relative now, you know, to what we know physiologically, you know, all the data suggests, you know, we were way overtraining.
Right. Like, but who knew? You guys were guinea pigs. The sport was brand new. To this day, we don't really know how best to train for it. Everybody's sort of learning as they go.
Yeah, we were learning as we go.
So the relationship between you and Scott Molina, I mean, you guys raced each other a lot, and a lot of times it was not necessarily for first and second, whatever place it was, you wanted to beat him and he wanted to beat you. Talk a little bit about just that, besides just the training every day, how important was it when you got into a race to try to take him down?
We were somewhat separated by our competitive, expertise. I was a little better at the long distance. He was better at short.
Right.
So if I could be close to him on an Olympic distance, USTS or something like that, you know, then even if it was second, I would consider that, a victory, second, third, whatever. But when he beat me in 88 in Ironman.
Yes.
After we had trained together in Palm Desert for a couple of weeks, where the average temperature every day was between 104 and 107, I was like, all right, that's it.
Yeah.
Now we need to fix this. There was never any animosity between any of us. You know, and of course people, the media wants to sort of build it up. Oh, these guys, trying to beat each other. And, I think there was this mutual respect. And
absolutely.
Everybody was different and,
All the guys were unique. And my favorite race of all time was Atlanta USTS with the fog there. And the fog clears, and all of a sudden there's a 1,500-foot swim course.
That's right.
The smile on your face with this miniature swim course where there was no way those guys could get rid of you in 1,500 feet.
No.
That was the best.
No, when I came out of the water with everybody else and we sat down in the transition area to change our shoes and get on our bikes, I looked around, at Basescu and Mark Supernod and Molina and all these great swimmers. you know, Charlie Graves.
Yeah.
And I looked at Charlie and I go, "Nice to see you so soon, Charlie. How you doing?" He was like, "Fuck you, Tinley."
That is the best. And that was like a tie, you and Melina, like, sprinting the line, and that was great.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah. He's kind of like, "Shit, you know, how much is your first place bonus?" "I think it's $300. How much is yours?" "Oh, it's from Nike. It's $500. I go, "All right, let's sprint and make it look real."
Yeah, we'll split it. That'd be good.
We'll split it.
I love it. That happens at bike racing all the time. That's what they do. That's what it's for.
Yeah. It's, again, I mean, in honor of the true competitive nature and, you know, that the veracity of what sports should be, like, we shouldn't have done that. But we did it once or twice, and we laugh at it now. So it was worth it just to be able to tell that story.
Absolutely.
30 years later.
Oh, I love that. So when you look back at all the racing, what do you were in a little different position than the other guys because you were also building a business. You started the Scott Tinley Performance Wear. So it was important for you to get to Australia and get to New Zealand, build the brand. And in the meantime, you're balancing. I know you're a guy who can do a lot of different stuff and at the same time, but you're building a brand, you're building a family, you're traveling the world, you're racing, you're trying to take care of all your sponsors. That balance, how hard was that?
Well, I wasn't the best husband at the time, put it that way. I was gone a lot.
Yep.
I was busy, but it was an exciting time for myself and our family when we were young. You know, we were working on the company, and we were hopeful that the sport would evolve to the point where, you know, it would. You know, again, not just from a financial standpoint, but it would, all of that efforts would have been paying off that would, you know, kind of put us in a position where we wouldn't have to be doing this for a long, long time. Because, you know, I mean, I looked at it, having got into it later in life, you know, relatively speaking for a professional athlete. I mean, I didn't make any money till I was probably 28 or 30.
Right.
You know, for a pro athlete, that's pretty late. But I thought, God, you know, I mean, I worked really hard to get here, and wouldn't it be nice if I could have a couple of good years and then figure out what's next?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a lot happening, but all of it was good. All of it was exciting, dynamic, fluid, great people around me. The travel was insane, you know,
yeah.
Just to be able to pick up the phone and go like, God, you know, let's call this racetrack. We've never been to Tahiti before. Let's go there and see if he'll give us a couple of tickets. And, you know, Tori was young. She's under 2 years old. She could fly for free. And the race director went, "Come on down." So, I mean, that was pretty cool.
That was,
you know,
really,
I mean,
fun.
You have to respect that period in the history of the sport and the history
fun.
Of our lives.
Well, think about it. I tell people all the time, everybody's talking about how serious Ironman is. I said, 85. ST is winning the race, and we are playing catch on the Queen Highway, right? With my little football, right? I'm in the back of a convertible. Lois is shooting. We're chatting. Where are you going for dinner? I mean, right now, everybody, you get queued if you do something like that. You're like a media person playing catch with a little football. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that crawling is officially against the rules now, right?
It might be, yes.
I'm pretty sure that it's...
I know cruisers are against the rules, and fixies are against the rules. There's a bunch of different stuff you can't... And you can't get stop and get a beer along the way. All that stuff is off the list. So,
yeah.
ST, when you look at your career and the, you know, 20 times in Ironman, what do you look at? I always look at, okay, the races the guy won. Those are the important races. What races do you look at is the most important to you?
Yeah, good question, Bob. I would say the first time I did it,
yep,
and I finished third because there was no expectations, and it was raw and it was organic and it was just completely natural, meaning that, you know, I was we're staying in a place for $20 a night with a bunch of other people, and it was just all of that kind of rootsy stuff you do as a kid.
Yep.
And then to end up third, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on the podium and going to the awards and having John Howard get up there and go, "I guess this proves that cyclists are the most fittest people on the planet." And I sort of think, like, wow, that's a interesting comment.
Yeah.
But that was a good one. And then I think the 90 race,
yes, 90.
Where I got second to Mark. I mean, from a performative standpoint, that was my best race.
Yes.
That was better than 85. 85 was, you know, it was a good race, but it was a kind of cherry pick. And it would have been a whole different thing if Mark and Dave and, you know, other guys would have been there.
Well, you broke the course record.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's because once we were playing football, the guy doing commentary on the NBC van was Dave Scott.
Yes.
He goes, Stanley, come on, dude. He goes, I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah.
He says, look, you need to break the course record. Otherwise, this whole thing's going to be like, it'll look like a charade. So can you just focus for a minute and try and run a little quicker?
That's right.
Like,
he did
okay,
say
good point, Dave. Okay, Bob, get rid of that football. Let's go.
And that sort of set up 86 when actually there was 100K. All of a sudden money came in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bob Drogan. The secret beneficiary that's underappreciated in the history.
He really is. Mr. Drogan coming up with 100K. He changed the face of the sport. It changed, because at that point, you know, Mark and Dave and yourself, you could go to other places and get money. You didn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the people who I think is underappreciated and it could have been amazing in the sport was your brother Jeff. He finished third mm-hmm. twice. How good could Jeff have been if he had stayed in, you think?
Well, I honestly believe he had more natural talent than I did. He was quicker in the run.
Yep.
He was a little bit lighter, a little more sinewy. You know, his body
yep.
type was a little closer to Mark's than myself. He just, you know, he went a different path. He just didn't want to take that risk of investing another year.
Sure.
Without you know, some guaranteed compensation. And, you know, we were both young and struggling and working multiple jobs. And, you know, I'm like, I'm going to give it one more season and see what happens. And he took a job with Adidas because, you know, we had met a tech rep,
yes.
you know, somewhere who said, hey, you guys are pretty good. You know, I always have these jobs available. You know, you go around from different shops and, you know, you talk about how cool the shoes are. It's not that bad. You make $600 a month. He's like, I'll do that.
And you were like, I'll do one more year and see if I can make it here.
I go, no, go for it, bro. But I'm pretty sure I can make $600 somewhere.
Yeah,
even if I'd have to, you know, race 2 weekends in a row and finish third and get 200 there and 200 there, then I think I can make maybe $1,000, which and I'd be living on Easy Street at $1,000 a month.
God. So, what besides Kona? What were some of your favorite races? Just in terms of locations.
I loved Bermuda.
Yeah, that was a great one.
Because it was like idyllic, and it was, you know, it was well run. It was kind of safe, just beautiful water. You know, great opportunities afterwards. A couple of the other, you know, the nondescript races in France besides Nice. You know, we'd race up in Avignon.
Yes, that was beautiful.
Which is beautiful. I mean, yeah, that was the only time I ever beat Mark Allen in a half Ironman. And they wanted to disqualify me because I didn't wear a shirt on the bike.
Oh, no.
It was a big brouhaha.
Really?
Yeah. Fortunately, I got out somehow. I don't know how, but I don't. They did these kind of one-off events. I mean, the early St. Croix was great.
Yep.
God, I don't know. I mean, Alcatraz was run by Golden Gate Productions before IMG took it and turned it into whatever it is now.
Yeah, with
and of course Wildflower. You know, I've always loved Wildflower.
Wildflower, so special. Yeah, that's really cool stuff. And Bahamas, Diamond Triathlon to the Stars.
Oh yeah. Bruce Portner.
You get some.
Oh my God, that he's still. You know, here's an interesting story. So not that many years ago, this person randomly called me up. She goes, hey, you know, do you know anything about Bruce Portner? Because I did an investment with him. And
major mistake, yeah.
I had to tell her the whole story about the diamonds. That, you know, I was supposed to be paid like $50,000 in diamonds and end up being like $500 in cubic zirconiums.
I mean, you know what's so funny about this sport? You think about those type of things with the, you know, the Rennie Rokers and those type of characters and Bruce Portner. And we've had our share. And then you've got, you know, you've got Dave Horning and people who are just creative and fun and sort of fit the sort of the mystique of the sport. And it's been in a pretty freaking amazing journey if you think about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least I was very naive for a long time.
Oh.
And then of course, you know, after you get ripped off so many times,
yep.
And you know, you believe in the goodness of a human being, and
I know.
And you know, they steal everything you have. I mean, here's Jerry Dominelli telling me personally.
Yes.
He goes, here, oh, this is just a problem I'm having with bankruptcy trustee. Don't worry about it. I'm going to take care of you, no problem. And, you know, Nancy Hoover, oh, yeah, no problem. It's just it's an accounting error. And, you know, my wife and I lost everything we had.
Wow. So, I didn't realize that.
I didn't realize that.
You
go through those things a couple times. You think, yeah, I don't want to become a cynic. I don't want to become hardened, but I need to be a little more cautious.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so,
you got to protect yourself. When did you get the feeling that you could actually make a living as an athlete?
Well, it didn't. it happened very late. Unfortunately, I was probably like 35 at the time.
Wow.
This is not bad. You know, I probably made decent money this year. I think when the Ironman World Series happened,
yep.
Which was, you know, just physiologically part of the worst thing you could ever put your body through.
You mean doing 5 Ironmans in a year? Oh, what could be the problem with that?
It was, to be correct, it was 4. But
oh,
that
sorry.
Didn't include the Nice race, which is nearly the same distance,
yep.
And, you know, several other, you know,
Sater,
the World Cup.
And, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I had a pretty good pace. I was tall and won the Ironman World Series. I remember getting a check for like $12,000 thinking, wow, okay, I've just beat the crap out of my body for the last 14 months, but I got $12,000. Forget this $14,000, you know, in past due bills, but I got $12,000.
Right. God.
But I did think that was, you know, it was signaling the future that, you know, they would start to reward people. I mean, regardless of the distance, whether it's Ironman or World Cup or Olympic sprint, whatever, that there would be some respect commercially for the opportunities.
Right. Well, are you surprised? I mean, we both grew up in the era where, you know, running events were looked at as an imposition for the city. You're keeping people from going to church and you're blocking off the roads, and triathlons were triple that. And now these events are welcomed because they put heads in beds. People are staying there, and the cities need income, and they can count on them. Are you surprised that just sort of the change in the dialogue about these events that were considered a pain in the butt, and now people are bidding to get them to come to their city?
Well, not really, because, you know, if you look at the demographics, right, everybody's aging up.
Yep.
You know, all the boomers, I mean, there's X 100,000 per day turn 60. So all these people, you know, they're not going to put pads on and go out and play tackle football on a Sunday afternoon with, you know, with another 10 people on their team. And what they want to do is they want to stay vital. They want to stay participating in some physical culture. And why not? Hiking and jogging and cycling and triathlon and, you know, enter next event there. And particularly, you know, when you add the entertainment connection.
Yes.
You know. The music, throw some color on you, you know,
right.
Go through a mud hole,
yep.
Whatever it is to make it a little more groovy, then boom, why not? And you know, the people are willing to spend tons of their discretionary income on that because, you know, you hit a certain point in your life, you go, God, I only got 10 good years left. So there's a whole bunch of us that are in that category. So to kind of see that explosion, you know, I think part of it can just be explained by, look, you know, we have the resources now, so why not spend $400, you know, on a triathlon? Because if I can spend that much on dinner, why shouldn't I have a good time, you know, and have a goal and hang out with my friends and then get a, you know, T-shirt and a medal around my neck? And so I think the participatory sport category is exploding for lots of reasons, but a lot of it is just, you know, just the boomers aging up.
And it's just fun. It's just fun. So in terms of your fitness level now, and I look at you and Mark and Melina and Dave Scott, I mean, everybody is still incredibly fit, but obviously doing other stuff. What surfing, cruising around on the bike? Do you run much? What do you do now?
A little bit of everything, you know, I mean, I kind of sort of hate to admit it, you know, publicly, but I, you know, I'm still out there like between 2 and 4 hours a day doing something.
Yep. Oh,
and I hope this isn't on the radio, Bob, because, you know, my students find out I'm actually, you know, not in my office and I'm riding my bike.
I love that. So, 2 to 4 hours a day still. That's great.
Yeah, doing something. You know, I mean, whatever it is, whatever I feel like doing. I mean, I try and get in the water, paddle, surf, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, and you know, do a little lifeguarding, ride my mountain bike, you know, go to the gym, do the executive workout thing. You know, so.
That's cool. You know, one of my favorite things was back in the day in the early 80s, because you were instrumental in the success of this. When we first started doing the riding ties on Thanksgiving and Easter with butt bikes from Dan Rock and, you know, two people and take turns running, riding and stealing other people's bikes and buggy riding them out there and looking for stuffed animals. You know, again, similar to the Ironman type of thing, it was something that was just silly, and that led to Muddy Buddy became a real thing.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's good. No, just, I mean, to see those kind of organic, rootsy things, you know, end up being, you know, a successful opportunity for lots of other people to experience it.
Yeah.
You know, and again, that's the problem with nostalgia. You know, we look back and go, God, that was so great back in the day. You know, there's no rules. Do what you want. But, you know, look, it wasn't that safe. There was no aid stations. We had
none.
Shitty equipment.
Exactly.
We didn't know what we're doing.
No. That. And what's great is it evolves, right? You start with something, and then you go, hey, I'd like to get more. It'd be fun for more people to participate in this and realize that fitness is for everybody. And, gosh, you can run 1 mile at a time and climb an obstacle and then go ride a bike. It changes everything. ST, always, thanks so much for being so kind with your time. When you look at at some of the athletes that impressed you, maybe outside of triathlon, who impressed you?
David Bailey.
Yes.
Yeah. Bailey's one of my heroes, just because, you know, multiple sports, multiple championships, against huge odds.
Exactly. I love
that. He's I mean, I got a lot of heroes. Most of them are disenfranchised heroes, you know, people who are struggling, you know, I mean, Barry Bonds, Kardashians, fuck those guys. You know, I mean, I look at the people who wrestle with the issues that a lot of us don't have to face, and they rise above that. And I go, that's the kind of guy I want to be in my next life.
Exactly. Like right now, it's just over at the CAF building. There's Carlos Maleda building out chairs for the.
Oh, he's so good.
He's just a tough mofo. That guy can do anything, and nothing gets in his way.
Yeah.
So I love it.
Fantastic people.
You're the best, man. Thank you so much for taking time.
Thanks for all your contributions, and always good to hear from you. Good luck with Babbittville.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks for visiting.
All right.
I'll get you a house. All right. Scott Tilley has been our guest again. We are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, VeloFix.com, Polar, Chase Your Destiny, Premium Plus Sports, Swim Run USA, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. Of course, visit us in Babbittville and check us out on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.